Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Everyone awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Great. Will you please pray with me? Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Dearest Master.
Beloved Mother. Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Bliss. Amen. This last week we marked the anniversary of Mother's Mahasamadhi, and it was a wonderful time, if we can describe it that way. I think we can, because in marking the life of Mother or any great saint, there is the sorrow of the passing. Remember the story of Mataji when Papa left the body, and it was long expected that Mataji would be the first one to go since she had had so many health problems, but Papa left the body. And Mataji was inconsolable in her grief, and she just tears and grief and just overwhelming for days, and then started to stretch into weeks. And some of the disciples began to worry about her and even ask her, Mataji, you are God realized, and yet you are grieving so much for Papa's passing. And she said, I don't grieve for myself. She says, I grieve for all of you. You had Papa here. He was here, and you didn't get the fullest benefit. You didn't get your complete God realization, and now what will you do that he is gone? And so she went on in this manner. And so it is the grief not just for individually, but for this world. The Mother was an embodiment of the highest light of the divine. And when she left the body in Mahasamadhi, it is true that a saint's ambience goes out all around this world, and that there is a grace that is released at that time for the entirety of the world. However, there is also the loss of the embodiment of the light at that time. And so we grieve for that we yearn for having that total and complete realization and desire it with every part of ourselves. Reading from the Cross and Lotus Journal, each thing denied us is a stepping stone to God. We are never satisfied with the life God has given us. We are never satisfied with the work that he has given us, nor the place to live, nor his provision for us. Yet no matter where we are, no matter what we have, this is God's will for us. As of this moment, wherever we live, whomever we serve, whatever the conditions of our lives, this we have written upon our own brows with our own hands at one time or another. It is the price that must be paid if we are to attain this oneness with God. And yet, we cry about it. Why do we not rejoice? Everything that is denied us in a worldly sense, everything that is taken away from us in a material sense, is but a stepping stone to a greater glory of God. Because of this pounding away like a pickaxe going on, we lose our desire for the worldly things, and we want this desire for God. It is said, seek first God and his kingdom, and all these other things shall be added unto you. The man of spirit could no more go back into a worldly life than he could fly, because he has found something so much greater, so much more joyful, so much more filled with ecstasy than anything he has ever experienced before. And the things of the senses have no comparison. Why should he return to that which is left for that which he has attained? Jesus the Christ said, I and my Father are one. And in truth, he found this oneness. But we too were born, not the sons of God, but the sons of men. We, like Jesus, the Son of Man, have to go through all of the trials and tribulations which are necessary to purify us, to raise our consciousness, because we suffer. This purifying process goes on. We become very different people than we used to be. Sometimes our desires are denied us. In reading from the Second Coming of Christ, chapter 3, And John answered, saying, Master, we saw one cast out devils in thy name, and followeth not us. And we forbade him, because he followeth not us. But Jesus said, Forbid him not, for there is no man which shall do a miracle in my name that can lightly speak evil of me. For he that is not against us is on our part. For whosoever shall give you a cup of water to drink in my name, because you belong to Christ, verily I say unto you, you shall not lose his reward. And whomsoever shall offend one of these little ones that believe in me, it is better for him that a millstone were hanged around his neck, and he were cast off into the sea. And if thy hand offend thee, cut it off. It is better for thee to enter life maimed than having two hands to go into hell and into the fire that never shall be quenched, where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched. And if thy foot offend thee, cut it off. It is better for thee to enter into life than having two feet that could be cast into hell and into the fire that shall never be quenched, where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. It is better for thee to enter into the kingdom of the eye, God, with one eye, than having two eyes, to be cast into hell fire, where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched. That is quite a teaching, isn't it? And Master's commentary. Any devotee who does not practice anything against our principles is naturally in tune with us. Any person who shall help you, even with a cup of water, when you are thirsty, will be rewarded because of the manifestation of Christ consciousness in the consciousness of all. Anyone who is in sympathy with you, all is in tune with Christ consciousness present in you and will be rewarded by expansion of consciousness. A person in tune with you will be automatically and sympathetically attract the qualities of Christ consciousness. This is a wonderful teaching that Master gives us here and shows the universality of these teachings. Jesus himself, when the disciples found somebody who wasn't following along, just along with perhaps Jesus' own teachings and his brand of spirituality, and yet was casting out devils. He had some power. He had some grace in God. And Jesus said not to forbid him. He traveled all over that area of the world, and when he came upon the Samaritans, who were generally considered as something outside of the tribes, and he spoke to the woman who was getting water from the well there, and he knew all about her life and what she had done, and he indicated so. And she said, Why are you speaking to me? Because he was a holy man, And technically, she would not be somebody who he would associate with or engage with. This is the universality of Christ consciousness. There is a joke about the devil that he was walking with a man one day and they saw another man walking along in front of them. And the man saw their truth lying down on the ground, and so he stooped over and he picked up truth and he picked it up. And the man walking with the devil looked at the devil and he says, "I bet you're worried now that man has truth." And the devil just stepped back and he says, "No, I'm not worried. I'll just let him organize it first and then it'll be all right. It'll all be in my kingdom then." Once we form an organization around anything, it can't help but begin to change it and disturb it in some way. Truth has to come directly from God, and yet all teachers are faced with the conundrum of how do you convey this? And how do you convey it to people of varying different qualities? Master used to say, "I'm running a spiritual hospital here, and people are in varying stages of recovery." And this explains a lot. You have to be able to reach out to people. You have to be able to reach out to them where they are at. If you are to give them a helping hand up, and yet you cannot forsake the absolute truth. You cannot twist it into something that doesn't fit. And there will always be lesser minds that will come along afterwards and will twist the teachings of a great master. I one time was thinking about Jesus and his foreknowledge about so many things that happen. And surely as one who was one with God before he took incarnation into this body, he had to know that his teachings would be twisted, they would be turned, they would be used for absolutely the opposite purpose for which he brought it. And yet the benefit to this world outweighed all of those negativities and the fact that they would be doing it in his name. These evil acts, and how much he was surrendered to God, how much his compassion reached out for the light, and to enlighten and uplift all mankind. And so people have taken these teachings, and sometimes they have taken off not only their own limbs, but they've taken off the limbs of other people in order to help them from doing a sin. Sometimes if somebody stole something, then their hand would be forfeited, and so on. And the hand here signifies greed. How do we reach out for this world? We reach out and grasp things. We get graspy, and we can feel that even energetically, even if our hands aren't actually grasping something. We want something so desperately. We want to grab that thing, and we want to hold it. We want to make it our own. And yet, for the man of God does not go into this world with a hand closed, but rather with a hand open. You see the symbol of the Buddha and of Jesus and of other great saints as they're portrayed pictorially. And they have their hands open. This is a sign of blessing. In one case, the Buddha has his one hand turned upward, his left hand, and he's receiving with that hand, and the right hand is reaching down and touching the ground. And that's a signal that his grace, his blessings, are going out to the world. And so he's receiving with one hand and giving out with another hand. You see Jesus with his hand held in a particular way called a mudra in the East. And it's with his forefinger and his thumb encircled, and then the fingers upright and the palm facing outward. And this is a symbol of teaching, and that infinity is held within the fingers, and then that is being sent out in grace through the open palm and the upstretched fingers. And so all of these things signify the inner consciousness. Now somebody can emulate them, they can imitate them in a blind kind of a way, but they can't really know the truth of it until they have gone all of the way. There are those who say that they attune themselves to Master. And then they give out advice based on that, and there's a telephone bank where the phone is answered, and supposedly each one of these individuals are giving out advice in Master's name. But the thing is it's all right and it's good to attune yourself to the Master and to always be thinking of the Master, but you can't really know for certain that you are giving out the advice from that highest consciousness from which Master did until you have attained that same state of consciousness. These two things cannot be confused. And so you can't institute these things. You can't create an organization that will manifest this highest divine consciousness. As Master said, and told Mother, he says, when I make a minister, he says, I don't look for anybody who's taken a certain amount of training and they've taken all the lessons and now they've graduated and they become a minister. He says, that's not the kind of ministers I want. He says, universities produce those kind of ministers, and they're doctors of divinity, DD, but I call them doctors of delusion. Because they haven't attained the truth. They have book learning, but they have not read directly into the book of life, which is God. And so this is an absolute necessity, and if you miss this point, and this is the tendency of organizations. They want to organize. They want to create laws. They want to create rules in order to try to keep everybody in line. And this is the nature of them. And yet, would Master go to, if he took incarnation once again, would he go to an organization in order to attain his full realization? You know that he would look for a true teacher, one who had attained their oneness with God. Just look at the autobiography of a yogi. Look at all the pains that he went to. All of his friends knew that he was hot on the trail for meeting saints and ultimately meeting his guru. And so they took great joy whenever they would discover somebody new and bring it to Master, and he would run off to meet them. Because he wanted to be with saints. And most of all, of course, his deep yearning was to meet one who could take him all the way to God. And he met some of the great ones before he met his own Satguru, Master Mahasya, Ram Gopal Mazumdar. There are many wonderful saints, Swami Kabalananda, or Keshabananda, excuse me, and so on. And so there were wonderful saints that he met. Both Kabalananda and Keshabananda, both disciples of Lari Mahasya. Swami Pranabananda, the saint with two bodies. These are magnificent saints, but not one of them was to be his Satguru. And Master Mahasya said, no, I'm not your guru. Your guru will come later and will convert your fathomless love for God into fathomless wisdom. And he spoke the truth. He spoke the truth. And so these are what we must do if we are to attain the highest consciousness. I remember when I was starting out on this path and I was trying to read books. I was trying to find anyone who could teach me the truth. I didn't know what that looked like exactly. And yet I knew that I was in delusion. I knew that I needed to meet somebody because I had read a book, and in reading that book, it told about a man meeting his guru. And in that, I recognized the truth of it. This is what I must needs do, is meet somebody who has known the truth, who knows God. I didn't have a name for it at the time. And yet, I had an intuitive apprehension of what I needed at the time, and that brought me to Mother. And it was through meeting Mother that she lifted me up. I had met other yogis. I had met other teachers. But I didn't find anybody who had what Mother had. And I felt the power of God within her, and I felt the wisdom, knew the wisdom as she spoke it out. And there was many things that she spoke of that I didn't know at the time. She spoke about Christ consciousness. I hadn't been trained to know what that meant. I had only had the traditional notions of it, and yet I knew Mother spoke with a different meaning than what I had ever known about before. And she used the word God, and before that, generally, I was looking for the nearest exit if I heard the word God. But she used it again in a way that I had not heard used before. It had a vibration to it. It had a power. It had a meaning that I knew went beyond anything that I understood, but it pointed me in the right direction. And so these were the markers. But still, I was tough to convince, and I was, for 2 years, I wrestled with it. Is this the right path? Is this the right thing? I knew it on one level, but my mind kept wrestling with it until I finally resolved it for myself, and that freed me to go forward. You know, you can't really know the truth that the Master teaches you until you yourself have realized it completely. Until then, some of it is through experience, but some of it is through faith. And only until you go the complete way can you know for certain deep within yourself that the Master has taught you the truth every step of the way. Now, there were things that Master taught and that Papa taught that Mother wasn't in full agreement with. And when she attained her own God realization, these were but minor details to her, because she knew that these masters were one with God. Now you can say, how is it that these masters are one with God and yet Mother ascertained that there was a truth different than what they taught? For one thing, each master comes with their own aspect of God to convey to this world. For Papa, it was total mindfulness of God, always remembering God through the wonderful and all-powerful chant of Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And we sing it often. And it is a wonderful chant. I remember the first night that I met Mother, I met her on a Wednesday night service, and she sang that chant. And I found it haunting. I wasn't even sure if I liked it in the beginning, because it haunted me rather than, but it stuck with me. And I couldn't forget it, and it kept coming back to me. And gradually, as I repeated it, it began to really take hold of me. You know, if you're changing your diet, you've gotten addicted to sugar or some other kind of food that's not so good for you, and you try to eat some good food, a carrot or an apple, you say, oh, it's all right, but it doesn't appeal to me very much because you're so addicted to the other food. But when you clean yourself out of the sugar, then gradually that carrot or that apple or that other natural sugar in food really begins to taste good to you. And similarly, when our mind is filled with things of the world, the things of God don't appeal to us. In fact, they can positively repel us because we're so addicted to this world, we don't appreciate the vibration of God and the upliftment of God. And that is what our sadhana is for, is to gradually wean us away from the things of the world and then to begin to really focus our attention upon God. But generally in the beginning, we have mixed motives. We have mixed desire nature. And we're like on a teeter-totter, and we can go either way with it. And if we don't be careful in what we put our mind to and how we think, then our mind can lean on the side of the world, and all the weight starts to take us down towards the world, and we start to lose our attraction for the things of the divine. Papa used to be afraid, desperately afraid, that he would somehow lose his desire for God. And so he would pray to God constantly to keep that desire first and foremost in his mind. We can't play fast and loose with it. And I have been guilty of that at different times in my sadhana. There were times when God came very easily to me, and there was a kind of momentum that went with me, and I would go with it. And then I would just do a little bit here and there that was a little bit off kilter, but the momentum would continue, and I continued to feel God consciousness. So I thought I had gotten away with it. And then I'd do a little more and a little more, and gradually I would start to slide down into the ravine. down into darkness, down into attraction of the world. And I would lose that connection with God. And it wasn't until I would get far down in the ravine that I realized what a miserable mess I had made of things. And then I had to get all myself together and make all the effort first to get back out of that dark ravine. And then get back up to where I once was before. Come to that same Y in the road that I had chosen wrongly. And make the right choice. And so there's a price that we have to pay. Now when Jesus said, it's better to lose your hand, it's not necessarily that you have to cut your hand off, thank goodness, or your foot, or your eye. But through Raja Yoga, we learn how to withdraw the life force from any particular part of your body. I talk to you often about how to tap into this life force that's constantly streaming to you from your spine, and to feel the spiritual force at your back, and to open yourself up to that. And yet, how quickly we forget about it. We walk out the door, and we get into the car, and suddenly we're back to the world, and we're only thinking about things of the world, and we completely forget about the rest. And yet, before that, we were feeling the bliss of the flow of God and the joy of God, the light of God, and it seemed like it would go on forever, and yet in a second we can be out of it again. And we've lost it. We have to do our spiritual practice. This cannot be overemphasized. We have to continue to focus and not take a vacation. There's never a vacation from your sadhana. Nor should we ever want a vacation, because it is through our spiritual practice that we get bliss, that we get peace, that we get love, that we get joy of God. And there is no comparison in a worldly sense. We can have pleasures, but with every pleasure, there is the opposite of pain. But with bliss, there is no opposite. If there is an opposite, it is the absence of bliss, but there's no opposite. In that sense, it is pure and it is always there. There is no opposite in this sense. With every part of duality, whatever we have can be taken away from us, but bliss need never be taken away from you. It can be with you always. Enlightenment can be with you always. And so we learn how to withdraw the life force from the hand, from the foot, from the eye, whatever is calling to you. And you draw it up into the spine, you withdraw that life force into the spine, and you focus it at the ajna, right here, this point between the eyebrows. And Master used to talk often about just keeping the attention here all through the day. And you can go about your other activities. You can be driving, you can be walking, you can be carrying on conversations with people. And you can keep your attention right there at the ajna, and you feel a slight pressure there, or a tingling life force that's there when you focus your attention there. And it turns into a magnet, and it draws you. And it draws the life force up. And when you activate this kundalini, it begins to draw you up. Now, it talks about the hellfire here and eternal damnation, the eternal hellfire. This is the purification. There's two aspects to hellfire. There's the aspect, the hellfire itself, is burning in the passions. If you've ever wanted something so badly, you just couldn't stand it. Either a person or an object. And it burned in you. And this is a kind of hellfire, and it's unquenchable. Because we may quench it for a moment by getting something. But then that desire nature continues on, and we just turn our attention to something else, and then to something else. We're never happy with what we have, as Mother talked about here. And whatever it is, whether it's our job, whether it's relationships, whether it's where we live, how much money we have, whatever it is, we're never happy with it. We always find fault with it. And to really accept that this is God's gift to you in this moment. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to accept it forever, that you can never change it, or that you can't work to change it if it's something that you would like to change. But in this moment, You accept it as God's will. People can become so embittered about life. People become so discouraged about, I'll never get what I want. Or what I have has been taken away from me, and now I just feel this anger and this bitterness about it. And people can literally go to their graves with that bitterness in their hearts, and you cannot, it doesn't take much of an imagination to see how that goes into the design of life, even when they travel into the astral, much less coming back into another worldly life. And these people are not pleasant people to be around. It's difficult. It makes life hellish. And so when we turn our minds to God and we accept what we have as being perfect for ourselves, not necessarily that it's perfect in a human sense, but that it's perfectly designed to fulfill our karma. It's perfectly designed in the sense that we take whatever is given to us and we begin to transform it. We lift it up into God consciousness. We present it to God. We give it to God. We surrender it to God. And in that way, we spiritualize it. Far better for us as individuals to go into hell with a saint than to go into heaven with a sinner, because if we went into heaven with a sinner, pretty soon the sinner would spoil heaven. It's an interesting thing when you think about the common conception that people live the lives that they do, they accept Jesus as their Savior, and then they go into heaven. And you just think about people's consciousness, so many people who haven't really done their work to make the transformation. But they expect heaven to conform exactly to what their notion of it is. But what if they meet somebody that they didn't like in the human life? Where is that feeling going to go? Is it just automatically going to change? That's part of their personality. They haven't done the work to change it. And so the moment they meet somebody that they don't like, suddenly they're cast down into hell. This actually happened to one of the Pandavas. And it was the eldest brother. And he went up into heaven, and there he saw the evil cousin who had been responsible for the millions of lives. And his guide into heaven there said, give him a kiss on the cheek. And he was horrified, and he said, no. He says, he's responsible for millions of lives. And now you want me to greet him into heaven? And suddenly he found himself transported down to hell. He asked, where are my brothers at? Virtuous, good, they're down in hell. Oh my goodness. So he decided to go down to hell. And there he was greeted by all of his brothers who had been virtuous in their lives. And the explanation was that no man living life can be all good or all bad. And therefore, whatever little bit of evil the brothers had to work out, they did that first, going down into hellish consciousness. And then they would rise up into heaven, having paid off whatever it was that they had earned in that life in terms of negativity. But the cousin who was evil had so little good to his name that he enjoyed that first, the first fruits in heaven, and then he would go down into hell and he would suffer the consequences of what he did. So sometimes it appears to us that people who are of evil intent seem to get away with things. They seem to prosper. They seem to get happiness. And people who try to lead good lives, who try to change their lives, they suffer. They have difficulties. They have challenges. And you look at this and you say, how is this fair? How is this right? And so it challenges us and our notions of what is right and what is good and what is the reward of that. So we understand that this world is complicated in that sense. And so we let all of that go. Does a just person receive justice, or does it seem like they just get pain for their good actions? And an evil person, do they suffer, or do they seem to get rewarded for their evil actions? And the truth is, some people seem to get rewarded. But what we know is that ultimately, this law catches up with each and every person. Now it begs the question of why God created it this way at all. If God is all bliss, if God is all joy, all light, why would he create evil? Why would he create anything that's negative? And perhaps the truth we need to go no further than to our films or to plays, where it's written, and if you just saw a play, if you just saw a film about where things always went on smoothly and there is just no problem, you'd probably lose interest in it in a short while. But if the play has an antagonist, if the play has somebody that is playing that opposing force, that creates the tension within the story, and that creates and holds our interest. And so God, in this creation, created these counterbalancing forces. And he created each one of us as souls. And we knew from the very beginning that we could remain free. We didn't have to enter into this delusion. We could enter into the world, but not be of the world. But as God has shown me, we made choices along the way. And we got fascinated with this creation. We wanted to experience it. We knew that we're eternally free souls, but we wanted to experience ourselves acting in a body and being in this world and what that was like. And so we chose step by step to become more and more focused upon a singular body, a singular conscious, to play this role, even as an actor would play the role. Now, you would never want an actor to go psychotic and to think that he is his role. Even though there are those who really try to put themselves into the role, there's a part of them who always knows that they're an actor. And if the director calls cut, they stop acting in the role in that moment. But we have forgotten that. If the director calls cut, we don't respond. We keep on thinking that we are that role. We've completely lost connection. We've become psychotic in that sense, spiritually psychotic. And we have come to believe that we are these delusional roles that we have taken on for the fun of it. And so everything takes on dire consequences then, because we are no longer free in our spiritual being. We believe that we die when this body dies. We believe that we are born when this body is born. We believe that we are limited to this body only, and we are limited to the pleasures and pains of this body. It's not the way that we are designed to be, and yet God gave us free will as individual souls. But we chose this. We chose this life that we have. You chose the life that you have in this moment, and whatever you like or don't like about it, you have chosen it. And the only way out of that is to choose God, is to go beyond the creation. Some people are just trying to make life better. They take on affirmations, they try to think positive, they try to do their work in order to improve themselves, in order to improve their lot in this life. But there comes a time when we realize that no matter how many changes we make, we're like the proverbial person who's on the deck of the Titanic rearranging the chairs. But the Titanic's going down one way or the other, so it doesn't make any difference how well they're lined up. They're all going under. And we realize that at some point, no matter how well we rearrange the deck chairs of this life, no matter what kind of money, wealth, prestige, safety, health of the body, no matter what, the ship's going to sink. And this was the conclusion that the Buddha came from when he was still Prince Siddhartha. And he realized that there was no profit in trying to rearrange the deck chairs. He needed to discover the truth that was beyond this material world. The truth of his being, the truth of reality. Was there a truth to be discovered? He had to know. And this was the driving force behind his spiritual practice until he finally attained the state of nirvana or samadhi. This too has to be our determination. It is said that the devil is in the details. And the more you go out into this world, the more you get encumbered with the things of the world. Now, we live in this world. And so it's a delicate balance. It's a little bit like trying to reform your eating habits. If you just could quit eating altogether, it might be easier than trying to choose the right foods and not get addicted to certain foods or respond to certain foods. But that's not the way that it is for us. We still have to eat. So we still have to be in this world, participate in this world, and it is right and it is good. Most of us have karma to pay off in this world. And so wherever we are chosen to serve, that actually becomes a means for us to extract ourselves the world by participating in this world, but participating in a new way. To do it as a service to God, to feel that God is the doer and this body, this mind, this heart is an instrument of action, that God is the one who acts through. God is the hand in this ego self and this body is the glove. But it is God who acts now through this body, through this mind, through this heart, through this soul. It is God who expresses himself as himself, and we are but a witness. This is the true nature of the ego. The ego should be strictly a witness to what is done through and around this body by the divine. But the ego has taken on a whole persona of its own, acting as if it is God, which of course it is not. But it is through activity in this world that we actually free ourselves from this world. So we cannot set aside this world as a means of just getting rid of it. We learn to withdraw ourselves from this world. We learn to withdraw ourselves from grasping consciousness that's represented by the hand. We get rid of that rajasic, always on the go, always moving that's represented by the foot. We get rid of the eye consciousness that is always searching out, looking out for the next thing. And Mother called these two eyes the two thieves on either side of the Christ that are upon the cross. And it is these two thieves that when we open these eyes, it draws us out into this world and into the reality of this world. And that's why they're so powerful. And that's why we close these eyes and turn the eyes up towards the singular eye of the Ajna. Let thine eye be single, and thy whole body shall be filled with light. This is the truth. Turn your eyes up. At first you see darkness, and then you see different flashing lights, and then you may see different images that come about from the unconscious mind, things, daydreams. And then as that gradually all begins to settle out, then you may have astral visions. And you'll see astral lights, but don't stop there. Don't get pulled into that. That's just another level of delusion. Keep going. Then you go up and in your mind's eye, you see the fabulous, expansive causal realms that are far more beautiful even than the astral. And even that is a distraction. Even that is a thin veil between you and the absolute divine. And it is not until you go beyond even the idea of being a being in God that there is any separation between you and the absolute. Then you are a freed being. A freed being, even while you are in a body. This is the great truth that all the great masters, all the great spiritual beings, all the great teachings have come to awaken us to awaken you to. It is time to give up delusion. Do not become a doctor of delusion. Be a realized being. You know, because these great names of Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, Rama, Lao Tzu, so many. They seem to stand up in a rarefied air, and in truth they do. They're tremendous. They're tremendous. As Sri Yukteswar said, that Babaji, in his realization, is so far beyond our state of realization that it's incomprehensible. But not to have that dishearten you. There's actually great hope in that. Because God consciousness continues to grow and grow and grow. The difference becomes, when you enter into that state of oneness with God, you may be aware of God on an atomic level or a molecular level, or on a solar system level, or a nebula, or a galaxy. And both are equally God. Both are equally God. And so when you connect with God on any level at all, you have your oneness with God, you see. It's only the mind that tricks you into thinking, oh, it's not enough, it's not big enough, it's not whatever enough. That's a trick of the mind. That's a trick of the ego. Receive God exactly where you experience Him. Open yourself to Him. Open the door and let Him flood in. Then let Him take you on the journey, you see. Your part is to remember God, is to keep your mind on God, to surrender to God, to love God. God needs to do the rest. What would you know to do? And so wherever you find God, wherever you sense Him, any time you turn your mind within, turn it to the heart center or turn it to the ajna, you'll feel some sense of the divine. You will. It may not be as much as you want. That's all right. Let that idea just go. It may be a tiny, tiny little thread. That's all right. Focus on that thread. Maybe a tiny little spark, but that spark, when you start to focus your mind on it and receive it, will start to grow. Master wrote about that, where he closed his two eyes and he was looking at the ajna and he saw there a tiny little flame of God and he tried to chase after it. He wanted it so much. You see, he's trying to grasp it with his hand. Huh? The more he went after it, the further the flame went away until it disappeared completely. Oh, it was maddening. Oh, it was Manning, and what a tendency that is. We want to grasp on to God, but we cannot. The hand is too small to embrace infinity. And so again, he closed his eyes, he's looked at it, and then the little flame began to grow and grow, and it got so big, and oh, it just maddened him, and he ran after it again, and it disappeared again. Happened over and over again until finally, he got it. And he just breathed and observed. And that flame started to grow and grow and grow. And then the flame engulfed him, you see. He didn't have to run after it. And it's actually just a delusive thought that it's something outside of us, that we have to go somewhere, do something in order to know God. God is with you in all of His greatness, even now. Even now. And so you open yourself to that divine consciousness. Get rid of the things of the ego. Get rid of all of that. Just become simple, childlike. Receive Him. The mind cannot embrace God. It can never be big enough. But when we suspend mind, we enter into consciousness. And consciousness can become God consciousness. You see? It's so simple. It's so simple. So Mother never wanted to emphasize the devil or evil or those kinds of things. It's not that they don't exist. They do. But keep your mind on God, because that's what will help you to move through all the steps and stages and spheres of this delusive force. God one time showed me a vision, and in this vision was a big CEO sitting behind his desk in a big chair, and people had all these different kinds of relationships with the big CEO, the big boss, the president of the universe. And some people never went up to the office to see the president. They knew that he existed. Maybe they saw pictures of him around in the organization. But he is a distant thought around kind of who he was. And then there was others who were managers and people, and they occasionally got brought into the office and they got to talk with the boss. And then there were those who were at the very top of the organization, and they mixed freely, more freely, but they always sat on the other side of the desk. They're very respectful. They came in. There's a distance still between them. And then one day the door burst open, and the big boss's grandchild ran into the boss, leaped into the air, and leaped into his lap. And oh, the boss was so happy. And the child was so familiar with this president of the universe and so free with him, and the boss was so free with that one. Be like that child. Don't stand on ceremony. Don't keep God at a distance. Rather, run into him. Leap upon his lap. Be embraced by him and embrace him. And feel that there is never any separation between you and he. Mother described, it's not everybody's cup of tea, but it's how Mother thought of God and sitting in his lap and tugging on his long beard and covering his cheeks and smooches. And it had that feeling of warmth and closeness. And that feeling that you are each other's. You see, and you don't need to stand on ceremony. Where would a formal prayer come in to someone that you felt was your very own, and they felt you were their very own? That would be a foreign language to such a one. And so this is the nature of the bhakti, of the one who loves God, can cut through everything else and just leap into the lap of God and not give any thought whatsoever to delusion or separation. Your only thought goes to God, goes to God. Will you please pray with me? O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my body. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my being. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he. Bow to the light within you. May the infinite divine ever keep you and lift you into his presence. And if we should ever fall, that he might lift us back up and remind us of who and what we really are, and set our feet upon the path once again.